live.
Okay, we'll start this public information exchange with Otter Tail Power Company. It is November 20th, 2018. Randy Christman, Chairman of the Commission, joined by Commissioners Brian Krasius and Julie Fedorchak. I don't have any opening comments or anything. Do either of you?
I do not.
I don't.
Okay, we have our newest addition to the Public Utilities Division. Adam is here. But why don't we go around the table for the recording and everybody state your name on the record. Commissioner Krasius. Commissioner Krasius and Fedorchak are already on the record, but... And just go around, and we have new mics, and so I don't think you have to, like, hold it almost right up against your mouth anymore. So
just keep it in front of you.
Patrick Fond, Public Service Commission.
Brian Draxton, Otter Tail Power.
Tim Rogelstad, Otter Tail Power.
Brad Tollerson, Otter Tail Power.
Victor Shook with Commission Staff.
Adam Redfin, also with Commission Staff.
Okay, who's going to... do the presentation.
Well, I will kick things off, and just want to first start by saying thanks for the opportunity to have this exchange today. We're looking forward to hopefully what we view as a dialogue, and I think and as we kind of think back to, we've been through the rate case and a lot of things, and we thought it'd be a good time to come in and give you guys an update on where we're at. And I would like to just say thanks for all the hard work, I think, on both parties on the rate case. I think we had, as our staff and your staff and the commission and the review, appreciate all the hard work that went into that, and I think constructive dialogue that occurred during that process. So very much appreciate that. The goal today is really just, as I mentioned, to give you an update on some of the things that are happening at OTP and a little bit maybe more on what we're thinking longer term. On some of our longer-term planning initiatives. So we're going to have two additional people, Bruce Gerhardson and Stephanie Hoff, but they were, yesterday we found out Bruce wasn't able to go today, and then like an hour before we were to leave, Stephanie was feeling ill. So I'm glad that we've got the three of us. And,
I hope we make it through the meeting.
Yes, yes, yes. So they send their regrets, but we're gonna fill in the gaps for the parts that they were gonna cover. So
that might be
our new name. Yes. So maybe we'll go to the next slide. Just the agenda. I think I've kind of given the overview, but fundamentally, some of the challenges that were market challenges and opportunities that are out there. And more importantly, what's happening at OTP, how are we responding to some of those things, as well as some of the industry trends, and finally, an update kind of on our resource plan and what we're looking at going forward. So maybe move to the next slide. And this is kind of a graphic. I'll wait till you get those in front of you. This is kind of a graphic of kind of how we summarize kind of the overall holistic view of what we're trying to accomplish as an organization. At the center, you can see what we call what matters to us are our values. So safety, integrity, resourcefulness, customer focus, and community. Those are things that don't change for us very often. In fact, I think, since I've been with the company for 29 years, I'm there may be been one time where we've modified maybe one of these values, but by and large, that's who we are. That's kind of the core. When we ultimately have to make decisions, hard decisions, we go back to those and we think about those and factor that into our decision making. On the outside, you see what's going on in the world, and that's the stuff that we're seeing on a daily basis. It's the trends. It's the longer term issues that are out there today. It's technology. A lot of the work on the renewables and storage, electric vehicles, cybersecurity. I mean, cyber's one that we wish that we didn't have to put such a priority on, but it's a hugely important one for us. And as much as I'd like to say that I think we put a lot of resources and we continue to work at it, but every day the bar moves on that one. And so that's one that we're going to continue to stay focused on and is really an important feature for us to make sure that we're meeting our commitments with that. Generation market changes. So, as we've seen the shift in the lower natural gas prices, It's changing a little bit now, but I think in the short for the short term. But I mean, fundamentally, you know, if we would have been here, four years ago for sure, you know, we would have never had bet that we had seen the gas prices be as low as they have for as long as they have been. The amount of renewables certainly going in, all playing into kind of the calculus of the overall generation market.
Can I ask a quick question on the natural gas?
Sure.
You said except for the short-term change, and I think it was, what, 442, 447 or ish?
Yeah.
But it's been in the 280, 290.
Yeah, gas has barely broken $3 in MMBTU in the last couple of years. And so what we've got going on right now is that we came into a fall. We had some unseasonably cool weather over a large part of the country. Storage levels have dropped where they store the natural gas in the underground caverns. Those storage levels are lower, so we're well below the five-year average storage levels, and that has driven gas prices up. So we've seen gas prices in recent weeks, for sure, starting with fours. So $4.25, $4.50, absolutely.
That's all storage.
Yep. So what we're seeing right now is that it looks like that concern over storage is going to persist through the winter season. So our forward markets for December, January, February show those elevated prices. But by the time you get out to next season, the market's assuming that a correction occurs, the storage is refilled, and we're back to the lower prices.
It's kind of interesting because there was not to get off track, but such a decoupling in terms of pricing mechanism between crude oil and nat gas for the last decade before they were in tandem essentially and that decoupled and now it seems to have briefly returned to
I think that the prices have followed more
pricing
mechanism,
if you will.
Crude remains an international market. Natural gas is local. It can only go so far. We have so much in the United States that that's really the key for why they've decoupled for us.
Yep, sorry.
No, great question. I mean, that's what we'd hope for here. A couple other things kind of on the world, you know, changes that are going on, you know, customer expectations, you know, the involvement of communities in, you know, interest in, you know, much more heightened interest in what we're doing, how we're serving them, things along those lines. So you've got all these things going on around, and, you know, and then we try to kind of dissect, okay, what is our role in that? And I think, you know, fundamentally, you know, we're an essential service provider. We take that very seriously. We're very proud of what we do and the service and the product that we produce and provide to our customers, and how we do that. And that's kind of through our mission statement and so forth. And so then it kind of gets back to, you know, what are we trying to accomplish from a company? And it really goes back to, you know, growing our business, achieving commercial and operational excellence, and developing our talent. And you may say, well, that's pretty broad, and it is. But you know, kind of year in and year out, that's what we're striving to do. And I think as we go through some of the initiatives that we have that we're going to cover today, they all fit within one of those three categories. And, you know, growth is obviously important from our perspective. You know, our vision statement is one of growth and success for us in the communities that we serve. I mean, we're directly dependent, or, you know, from an OTP perspective, on the success of our communities. If they're healthy and they're being able to create jobs and grow, that's going to give us more opportunities to sell more kilowatt hours. And so that's an important piece of being able to continue to show that we're growing as an organization. On the operational excellence, you know, again, at the end of the day, you know, how are we operating our system? Are we providing the level of service that our customers are desiring? Are we doing it in an economic way? Are we doing it in an environmentally responsible way? Those are all key components. And our view is that we have to be operating at operational excellence before we're really allowed to grow, before we can expand and do more things. We want to make sure that we're really taking care of business on how we're operating our system. And then finally, we can have the best laid plans in the world, but without the people to execute on them, It's all for nothing. And so at the end of the day, what from how we are as a company, it's our employees and how they do and how they perform and making sure that we're getting them the training, developing future leaders for our organization is another key component of what we do as part of our strategy. So with that, we're going to transition into some of the
Stephanie.
Specific things.
She's not here, so I'm going to be. I found this out like just before we came out here. So if it's not as polished as usual, you'll understand why. So anyway, in the 2018 J.D. Power Customer Satisfaction Survey, we rank in the top three among our peer utilities. And we say our peer utilities, we look at our utilities in North and South Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin. It's kind of the area that we look at and similar sizes. One of the things I think customers really get used to seeing today is they really expect a lot of personalized information at their fingertips. I mean, things like, I don't know if you've been to the doctor recently, but now my lab reports come online. Right? You get an email that says, here's the result of your lab reports, and you can go back and look at your past lab reports, Amazon, all those things. People are just so used to having a lot of information. And I think that's one of the areas that, we're with our new CIS-1 project, which we'll talk about more here in a few minutes. And we're really trying to give that to our customers. So one of the things that we're going to be focused on better outage communications. That's really important when we do have these outages. I don't think customers mind so much that they have an outage, but what they want to know is, how long is it going to last? When am I going to get my power back? As long as you can communicate that, people are reasonably happy that you're doing the best you can to get them back on as soon as possible. So we'll be concentrating on that with outage maps, try to have increased communications between our customer service reps in the field and the customer service reps in the office. CIS-1, like I mentioned before, will help us provide some enhanced services to our customers. And then in the long term, which is something we'll also talk about as we move ahead, we're looking at automated meter reading and OMS. What does that stand for?
Outage Management.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Didn't get the acronyms.
Stephanie would have known that. Yeah.
In fact, I was hoping you wouldn't take this because if she goes back and listens to it, I'll get the business about this. So anyway, we're trying to increase our power quality and reliability and through a system improvement and reliability initiative. And one of the things also we're trying to do is enhance our customer experience through improvement of our website. Customers are mobile, like we all are, right? Everything you do depends on your phone. And when people are out traveling about, we want people to be able to have communication with Otter Tail Power, see their bills, do whatever it is. Because as we, not me, I'm too old to worry about that, but the young people today, they expect that. It almost isn't an option anymore. They just expect to have that. So it's something that we're trying to do. And lastly, and I think this is really important, and Tim mentioned a little bit to start out, we really try to be visible in our communities because it's interesting. I wish I had brought the map with, but sometimes you see our service territory map, and it's this big service territory that covers western Minnesota and eastern half of North Dakota and northeast South Dakota. Looks like this big contiguous service territory. But we took and we actually took where do we really serve, which is mostly the towns. And boy, that's really scary when you look at our service territory. It's this 70,000 square miles. It's got a bunch of little dots in it. And you think about how we're able to keep our rates low, I think, and have great service. When you look at that spread out service, I was in the cities a couple of weeks ago, and we looked out the window, and I said, you can see more customers out the window than we have altogether. And then they're spread over 475 different towns. And so, I think, but we do realize that those towns, most of them being small, they're really the backbone and the bread and butter for our company. So that for us to be successful, we need those communities to be successful too. So I think that's one of the things that we really do focus on and attempt to keep that going because we do know that that's our bread and butter. So.
All right. Well, I'm gonna cover for Bruce now. So moving on to the customer information system that's up on the screen, I understand that you've learned a fair amount about this project through the rate case that was recently underway, and we certainly appreciate the Commission's support for this effort. The last system we had in place was a homegrown system. It was developed by computer developers in-house at Otter Tail Power, and so replacing that system that has so many connections to all kinds of other systems within the organization as well as just the huge impacts that it has on rates for customers as well as billing impacts, makes it just a very, very important and sensitive project for Otter Tail. We are in the last phases of integration of that system, and we're now targeting a go-live the 1st of January of 2019, so we're getting very close to launching it, and everyone is very excited to finish that program and get it online. Training is well underway, and but again, just reiterating, because it is the primary interface that many of our customers or all of our customers have with our company, we're doing everything we can to make sure that we minimize any disruption, this transition in cutting over from the legacy system to the new CIS system might have on customers.
Was January 1st the time we had expected when we did the rate case?
Yes, that's okay. I think, you know, the kind of the in-service has evolved over time, but it's my understanding that January 1 was when the final order was issued, that was the expected date, and that's kind of tied to when we plan to implement the final rates as well.
Yep. I think while the rate case was underway, we were thinking October 1, but I think that fell away.
Correct.
Yep. Kind of in between the hearing that we had and then the final commission order and settlement. So no, January 1 is the current expectation.
Correct.
On all sides.
Yeah. And, you know, I would just say that, you know, this has been a very complex project in the sense that it's, as Brad indicated, it touches so many different systems. And then at the end of the day, it produces the bill that goes out to the customer. And there is nothing that we want more that we want to get right is producing the correct bill. And so, you know, the diligence in ensuring that system's ready is massive as we go through it. And so we've got a lot of work ahead of us between now and January 1, but as we speak, we're on target to hit that date. So,
and I'm sure you've had mailers into your customers about this coming, or they have had some communication prior to going live that this is happening, or their bill might look different, or anything like that.
You know, I'm, and unfortunately, Stephanie's not
correct.
You'd have the answer. It's my understanding. My recollection is that we have, but one of the things with respect to the bills, we've tried to make them identical. I mean, it'll be very hard for a customer to see that the bill will. We worked hard to have the bill presentment look very similar.
Okay, so there isn't a big learning period for, and a bunch of calls that you're going to get saying, "What?
We
want to minimize those."
Here.
Yes, absolutely.
That was the intention.
All right. So.
What's the rates certification?
So that's basically saying is the system calculating the rates based on what our approved rates allow? So it's
internal information.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep. It's a terminology that we're using as far as basically proving out that the rates that we've been that have been approved, that we're applying them correctly in this new system.
Any other questions on CIS? Otherwise, we'll go to new generation, and this actually is my slide. this is why I came, just to talk about this one. So, as you're well aware, we have two new generation projects under development and soon to be under construction. The Astoria Station is the graphic on the left. That's the new natural gas unit that we are working to develop in northeastern South Dakota. It'll be about a 250-megawatt simple cycle unit located by the city or town of Astoria. Right at the junction of the northern border natural gas line, so it's a very large interstate natural gas line going across the Midwest. And the intersection of that gas line and the Big Stone South to Brookings new 345 kV transmission line. So it's a very robust location for that new generator. Project is moving along very well. We've received all of our permits. We recently signed the generator interconnection agreement with MISO. Still working through the facility construction agreements, but all of that is moving along really well and according to plan. We're in advanced negotiations with a turbine vendor, and we'll be making that decision and executing those agreements before long, so we know the specific technology and overall cost and construction timelines all remain on track as we originally discussed with the commission as we went through the ADP process some time ago. We'll actually start breaking ground in 2019 with much of the civil construction and site preparation, and ultimately be testing the unit by the fall of 2020 with commercial operation shortly thereafter in time to be in service when we retire Hoot Lake Station in May of 2021. So certainly thanks to you for your support of that important project and the decision on the ADP. So that's the gas side of our generation plan. The wind side is the Maricourt Wind Project, 150 megawatts, near the town of Maricourt in southeastern North Dakota. Project is moving along well also in that we have all of the land rights procured and ready. We have a completed site permit, PTC parts that are required to ensure eligibility for the production tax credit have all been manufactured and are in place. And again, we have a completed ADP here in North Dakota, as well as approval for Minnesota through the Minnesota Renewable Energy Rider. Like most wind projects in North Dakota or this part of the country right now, the interconnection with the Midwest ISO continues to be the one issue that we're working our way through. But there has been a fair amount of good news on that front as of late as projects advance in the queue cycle that Maricourt is presently in. About 60% of the projects dropped out in this most recent decision point. So as the queue advances and the milestone payments become higher, every project has to make a decision as to whether or not they're going to stay in or go. And with 60% of the projects coming out of the queue in this part of the country, that greatly aids those projects remaining in terms of being able to interconnect on a timely and affordable basis.
So can you remind me, where is Maricourt?
Maricourt is down in the Ellendale area, okay. Is the easiest way to describe.
Yeah. I know we permitted it, but and you do not have an interconnection agreement for that?
We do not have a signed interconnection yet at this point.
And are you in the pool of projects that can have been accounted for on existing space on that system? Or because I'm hearing there's this grouping of projects that have kind of already been accounted for, and then because MISO's starting to talk a lot about how there is no more room beyond what we've accounted for and we have to build more. So which block are you in?
It's not quite that simple as either being in the block that has room versus those that don't. Every queue cycle that comes through is consuming more and more of the incumbent transfer capability on the system. But really, every queue cycle that comes through, there are certain amounts of upgrades that are going to be required. New lines that will have to be built, certain lines that will need to be upgraded, et cetera. I think that what we've learned in this August 2016 queue cycle with the 60% of projects dropping out is that MISO is now forecasting that the major baseline projects that they were anticipating might have to be constructed, major 345 lines across southern Minnesota or into Wisconsin, those projects are no longer a part of the August 2016 cycle. So if we want to kind of draw a line as to where the major upgrades are going to be required just to facilitate additional renewables, I think we can say that's now beyond Maricourt, where the system really needs to be reconstructed. But again, every queue cycle that goes through requires some upgrades, and we expect that to be the case.
Yeah. It's that ladder that you just mentioned that I'm hearing about.
Yep. So it is coming.
Mm-hmm. When do you expect that to be, your interconnect issues to be taken care of with MISO for Maricourt?
You know, there are a couple of different things that are underway with Maricourt. There is the interconnection request that's in the August 2016 cycle, and that would probably be expected maybe the third quarter of 2019 to be finalized. There's also an old GIA or interconnection agreement related to Mericourt that's been under discussion with EDF and MISO that was terminated back in the day, and there have been some settlement discussions underway with that. And if by chance that moves forward, we would expect something on that sooner, potentially in the first or second quarter of 2019.
When are you counting on this power?
So we expect the unit to be on no later than the end of 2020, when the full production tax credit requires it to be on, and we believe we have very viable paths to get there.
Okay.
Any other questions?
And are you building this one?
EDF will be building it. And
you're buying it from them?
We're going to buy the development assets and then hire them to construct the facility.
So if something falls through on the interconnect or there's some unanticipated delay, who's at risk?
So we will not, our intention is not to close on the project or proceed with construction until we have reasonable assurance on the interconnection agreement. So we are not committed yet at this point to closing until that's in place.
All right.
What are the commitments that were made that locked in the PTCs?
Yep. So EDF had to procure 5% of the overall cost of the project through purchase of turbines from the manufacturer, from Vestas. So Vestas is going to manufacture the turbines. They have put those on the ground outside of their production facility in Colorado, and EDF has taken title to those machines, and those are dedicated to the Mericourt wind farm project. And so by having invested in excess of 5% of the overall project cost, provided the project is online by the end of 2020, we will receive 100% PTC on that facility.
So if something falls through with the interconnection or something like that, Otter Tail Power wouldn't have any...
We do not have responsibility for those costs. EDF has taken on that risk. Any other questions on Mericourt? All right, I'm going to flip hats again. I'm Bruce now. So Innovation 2030 is the next topic. Brian, there we go. You know, as you're aware, Otter Tail's always been committed to low-cost, reliable, and responsive customer service, and that's what our customers in our system have really grown to expect of us. In the last couple of decades, though, we realized that a lot of technology in terms of how the business operates has continued to advance, and we have not necessarily implemented all of those technologies, whereas other utilities have implemented many of those advancements onto their system, and we believe we can and should do that same thing. So we've launched the Innovation 2030 initiative to take a look at a large number of potential technical advancements or improvements that we could have for operating our transmission and distribution system or for customer service, some of these outage management systems, workforce management systems that have been mentioned earlier fall into this. And so the CIS 1 project that we talked about earlier that's very close to launch becomes the backbone for a lot of these potential information technology and technology tools that we would have looking forward that would help improve customer service. So we have this new program in place under the banner of Innovation 2030 to look at these potential new technologies, whether it's automated metering infrastructure, telecommunications, geographic information systems, outage management systems, etc. And the plan is to incrementally work our way through the evaluation of each of those additional projects that we can use to improve customer service and or lower costs, and potentially roll those out over the course of the next many years. So this project is really in the planning and development phase as we look at how each of those components might best fit with our current system and customer needs and wants, but we're definitely heading down the path of examining many of these potential projects with the eye towards implementing many of them.
Tim? Maybe one other thing that I'll add, and again, is Brad, we're still very much in the planning process of this, but another component, so we've got the technology component, And then there's what we characterize as we call our System Improvement Reliability Initiative, or SERI. It's in the green there on the top. And that's, you know, whether you want to call it grid modernization, resilience of your delivery system, those sorts of things, that's the component of that. So what are the these things that we should be looking at on our specifically our delivery system to improve the performance of it? And so that's a component of this as well. So making sure that we're replacing our system, in an orderly fashion, taking a hard look at that. Where are we going to get the most bang for our buck? Is there some technology that we can use to improve reliability? Those sorts of things. So that's another kind of big component that we see as part of our Innovation 2030 initiative.
And where does most of that fall on? Adding additional things like technology? Or is it most of it the old fundamentals of replacing poles and wires and transformers? Where is there somewhere where the bulk of this occurs?
Sure. I think we certainly want to have an eye towards technology and new innovation as we look at it. But at the end of the day, we got a lot of poles and wires and transformers that are out there. But, for example, I think a big thing, as you look at our system and the rural nature and the large geographic area that we have an extensive 41.6 kV system that effectively connects all the smaller communities that we serve. And how can we automate restoration? One of our biggest challenges is, restoration of that system when we have a problem. And so are there, automated switches that we can implement? In a lot of big urban areas, you'll talk about the smart grid and high-speed automated switching that occurs in downtown feeders. I mean, very technical jargon, but really intended to really keep the lights on all the time and effectively. We're in a different situation. I mean, we have maybe a handful of communities where that would apply. Jamestown would be one. Bemidji, Fergus Falls would maybe be another, where we have enough mass of, density of customers where we could utilize some of that type of technology. But we have to apply it to the kind of more of the rural areas. And so what is it that can help us improve, specifically focused on reducing the outage restoration time, or in both cases, ultimately eliminating any type of outages that we have. So it's a combination of utilizing newer switching technologies that can allow us to do more remote restoration, as opposed to having to send, identify where the problem is on the system. Or we get a customer calling us saying, hey, I'm out of power. Based on the number of calls that we receive, we can kind of judge where we think the problem is. We'll send a crew out to, identify where's the problem at. And they'll have to physically go out, look for it. They'll identify it. Then they'll say, okay, here we need, we've got two poles down as a result of this windstorm. We'll have to, have another crew bring the poles out so we can get the system restored. In the future, it might be, and this gets back that are based on the number of calls that we get, we're going to be able to very specifically, kind of in a automated way, say, go look at this specific line section. So rather than one of our service representatives having to travel a line that may be 50 miles long, we can go and say, go look at this 10-mile section so we can get there quicker. We also may be able to predict that what the problem is, potentially. How do you use drones? Maybe you can use that with drones. But the other component of it is that, today when we have an outage on our 41.6 system, typically we have to send people out to switches to say, open this switch, isolate the problem, close this switch. We may have to have two or three, and in some times maybe several people involved in a series of switching activities. In the future, we might be able to do that all remotely. We're not there yet, but these are the sorts of things that we're looking at. So it's a combination of using technology, but then the other component is if we look at a line and we look at its performance over time, and we see that, again, it may be a 50-mile line, but you know, 90% of the interruptions are occurring in this 5-mile section. What can we apply to that 5-mile section? Do we go rebuild it? Do we apply lightning arresters? Do we put a shield wire? I mean, there's various things. So very targeted solutions is what our intentions are.
Can you talk some about cybersecurity and what you guys are looking at, what sorts of things you've done to harden the system, that type of effort?
Sure. So we think about cyber in kind of two systems for us. We have what we call our industrial system, which is our power system. So this is what our generators are connected to, what our control center is, the transmission facilities. It's a very separate and distinct network. You know, it's interconnected, or it's tied to other utility systems via, the internet, if you will. But it's separate from our business system, or what we call our enterprise system. So, how we bill our customers, how we keep our customer information, how we can keep our employees' information, and so we think of our We always think about our industrial and our enterprise system. NERC has, significant standards for which we need to comply with on the industrial side. So we're, always striving to be more than fully compliant with that, and always looking for ways to say, what are these other things? So we work a lot with, certainly other utilities, government agencies like the Department of Homeland Security. There's a myriad of acronyms out there. EISAC is one that's very active on the utility side of things, but constantly sharing best practices, sharing threats that if somebody noticed that something has happened on our system or on their system, that we're able to get, a big challenge, quite frankly, has been. A lot of times people will know that there's something going on, but they can't tell anybody, that particularly case in the government because of it's highly confidential mm-hmm. and classified. Yet, if we know something as a utility operator operating that we should be on the lookout, there's some challenges sometimes being able to get clear, direct communication. It's certainly improved, but I think we're always looking at ways for how we can get better information to know that there may be a higher threat level or what have you. So that's kind of our industrial system. On our enterprise system, again, it's more, it is not as regulated, from a compliance perspective. But nonetheless, we're trying to learn and take some of our best practices that we have on our industrial system, apply it over to our enterprise system as well. And, continually, looking at, how do we minimize? So, examples, I think we've made the decision that we used to carry customer social security numbers for the purposes of setting up an account. That's one example of a piece of data that we are no longer going to continue to hold on our system. We just feel like if our system is breached, that's something that, it was primarily used in bill collection purposes. And it's just a decision that we've made that we feel like, there's certain things we need. That's one thing we don't need. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to minimize. So trying to minimize your crown jewels is, right. Is a term that we use on the data that we have that we're trying to protect. But it's an ongoing, ever-evolving challenge for us.
Have those Social Security numbers been completely purged?
I don't think we're done yet.
Not done yet.
No, that's kind of we're moving. What I'd characterize as we're moving towards getting that. And I think step one is the new CIS-1 system, our new customer information system, won't have that data. The old system, the legacy system, does.
Do you have a timeline in mind or estimation in terms of when that?
I would suspect that it's going to be done within the year, but I. It may be done earlier as part of this challenge, as we think. I think part of it is just knowing where all your data resides. I mean, it's some of this stuff seems simple, but when you think about, you know, being able to clearly articulate, okay, these are the sets of data that we view as our crown jewels. Are they the only sets on our system, or did somebody, you know, download this file that, you know, a dozen years ago that resides on some computer? I mean, it's going through that process of sorting out and, you know, purging that information is a lot. It sounds easy, but to implement it, it's harder.
Do you think the standards are good enough, the NERC standards in particular? Is it clear enough? Are the companies getting strong signals for what needs to be done? And
I mean, I think our view on that would be that, yeah, I think the standards that are there are good, but I think the challenge is the speed at which, if something changes and you need to have something more, that it still takes quite a bit of time before you move to implement the standard. So I'll say that, but I think in practical purposes, and I don't know for OTP's perspective, and I quite frankly think most utilities are doing this as well, if we know that there's something out there, even if there's not a standard, and we think it's a high risk thing, we're not going to wait for the standard to implement. You know, I think there, you know, just some of the things that we see, you know, with the control system at a power plant. I'm thinking of maybe Brad, you can share the example of that one.
This is the the system that had to be updated at the various plants. Yeah, okay. So part of our control system at our coal units and our natural gas and oil units is provided by the system is called Ovation, but inside of that there is an antivirus software called Kaspersky, which had a Russian origin. And so there was just an alert provided to the industry that this antivirus software is out there. It may not have any immediate concerns. In fact, it doesn't. But, you know, if you have the opportunity, please develop a transition plan, or you might want to consider a transition plan to move away from that. And so we've proceeded with doing that and getting that software replaced on all of our units that have that antivirus software embedded in the system. So that's an example of some of the changes that are being made that aren't necessarily dictated or directed through standards.
So I didn't understand that question. I understood you to say that you think NERC standards are pretty good, but you even exceed them when you think it's important.
Yeah.
Were you talking about just on cybersecurity, or were you talking about overall NERC reliability standards? Do you think those are as fussy as they ought to be?
Yeah, okay. Good. Another great question. So just to be clear, I mean, my response was specific to the cybersecurity piece.
And maybe you want to stay on schedule and get back to this later.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think we've got time. We can address it now. What I would say on the kind of the reliability side of things, I think what I would characterize is the speed of change that's occurring on kind of the reliability standards or the need to adjust reliability standards is at a lesser pace than from a cyber perspective. I mean, the cyber is just kind of moving at, you know, very rapidly. On the from a reliability standard, you know, and I, when I think back you know, I had early on in my career, I had a fair amount of involvement in that. And, you know, at that point in time, everything was voluntary. And by and large, I think we were doing a lot of the things that today standards, I mean, again, if you focus on the poles and wires and generation side of the system, that the standards haven't really changed. What the standards have done is really made us prove out that we're doing what we said we were doing, you know, decades ago. So whether it's our vegetation management, meaning proving out that we are following through on making sure that our vegetation management or tree trimming is occurring on the, you know, the period of time that we said that we were going to get it done. Relay testing, so going into substations and making sure that we're proving out that our systems, testing out that our systems work, that we're documenting the results of those tests. So I would characterize a lot of that as more of the documentation side than it is the is it really improving the reliability aspect. Now, unfortunately, I think we had to go there because not everyone was addressing or, you know, following through on these, you know, the appropriate timelines for doing the relay testing, the appropriate timelines for doing their vegetation management. And I don't want to make it sound like we don't think that some of the new standards have not helped reliability, but I would just say that the fundamental purpose of what they're trying to accomplish, I don't think has changed near as much as what we've seen on the cyber side. Now, I think the big, probably the question you're interested in is the resilience question about generation and how are we going to ensure that as we've, as the, you know, you go back 10 years ago, you go back 20 years, you go back 20 years ago, there was virtually a very negligible amount of non-dispatchable generation, meaning everything that was on the system had a throttle on it, and you could step on it or pull it back, and you could operate the system very reliably. As you add the renewables, the non-dispatchable renewables like wind and like solar, you know, you've lost the ability to, say, turn it on. You can always shut them off, but you can't always, say, you know, ramp up the wind. Unless the wind's going to blow harder, it's not going to happen. So as there's more penetration of these non-dispatchable generation, we got to make sure that there's enough, that the system operator has enough tools available to be able to continue to operate the system reliably. And that's, you know, we haven't, in our viewpoint, hit that point in time where there's so many non-dispatchable generation, so much non-dispatchable generation that we can't reliably operate the system. And, you know, Brad's probably closer to this than most on this component of it, but it's certainly something that you're hearing more and more about. I think the, you know, whether it's the, you know, the dependence upon the natural gas system, I think it's more of an particularly an issue more so out in the Northeast, that if you lose a certain gas line, you're taking out a bunch of generation. In the past, we as an industry spent a lot of time just looking at the electrical system, not really focusing on the what's happening on the natural gas system. But as more and more gas is added, as more and more non-dispatchables added, we have to look at more of these different scenarios. And this gets into the, you know, the, I think the Trump administration's proposal to say, if you've got, you need to measure performance based on if they've got a 30-day supply of fuel. You know, so nuclear and coal facilities certainly are, you know, would fit that type of criteria. So it's a, that it's becoming a front and center, you know, and I don't think we would term it as a reliability issue at this point in time, but it could become a reliability issue going forward.
I suppose the report comes out soon again. I think it's always toward the end of the year. Is NERC a good standard for evaluating things, or is it just not really a very, very useful tool?
So I think the report that you're talking about is so that is the are these regions going to have enough generation to serve the load for the coming season?
Yeah.
Is that, do you have any comments on that, Brad? Or
you know, I think the MISO does an evaluation of the MISO system seasonally as well, just to make sure that there is enough generating capability. We do some forecast to MISO where we take a look at what our fleet is going to look like over the course of the next number of years and submit that information. And I think we're reasonably confident in the data and the information that comes back out of that report or the NERC assessments that are out there. I don't think that we necessarily doubt or have any concerns about those assessments that the industry is doing.
Just to follow up a little bit, and I hate to belabor this, but of all the issues happening, in, I think this is pretty high on our all of our radar in terms of concerns, just because of the speed of change in the adoption of the renewables and dispatch non-dispatchable and the retirements. But so I'm hearing everywhere I go, I'm hearing about this, and from different parties and different venues. Some last most recently it was from somebody who was from California talking about, and he's all about renewables, et cetera, but basically saying, you know, we haven't figured out how we're going to replace the items on the grid that we're currently getting for free from the thermal generators, you know, how we're going to replace those on the grid. And then MISO's talking a lot about through their RAN, Initiative Resource Adequacy and Need, and looking at kind of the same thing. They don't call it necessarily these same things, but again, it's basically getting back to attributes. Now, I've been frustrated because I talk about this all the time on OMS, and I'm here. I've got some fellow commissioners nodding, saying, "Yeah, we do need to recognize attributes. We do," but we also get serious resistance from some because they get all kind of defensive because of the whole Trump thing and the resilience and the, you know, this is just an effort. Anytime anybody talks about this, it's just an effort to give money to coal to make them last longer. Well, okay, we have to get past that and talk about the legitimate issue of reliability. Take coal out of it. I mean, I like coal. Coal has great attributes. But this is beyond just hating coal. This is how are we going to build a system long-term that recognizes the strengths and weaknesses of all the resources and provides a pathway for long-term reliability. And so I've been kind of frustrated with the utilities. You guys don't speak up in this conversation that I've heard through the MISO organizations. Mm-hmm. I've even had some of the utilities that we regulate say, this isn't MISO's issue. We take care of this in our resource planning. Well, that's fine as long as your customers are willing to pay for the reliability that your thermal units or are providing for everybody else in the system for free. I believe this needs to be handled through the markets, through some sort of a market mechanism that makes everybody pay for the attributes that these resources are providing, regardless of which customers ultimately own them and have them in their rate base.
Yep. And so to speak to that, there are a couple aspects to it. One is I don't think everyone fully appreciates what's in place today in terms of how different resource types are valued by the market. MISO currently has an ancillary services market that provides for regulation following load and deviations on the system every 4 seconds. Only dispatchable units can provide that. They're being paid to provide that service. Spinning reserves.
What if they don't exist, Brad? What if those units are being retired because that, I mean, they aren't getting enough of a payment in that market?
No, I'm just going through to say there are certain of these payments out there that exist today. Whether they're adequate becomes the long-term planning question, right?
Right. So I interrupted you. What other ones were you going to mention? I'm sorry.
So then there's spinning reserve. Only units that are dispatchable to ramp up to fill a need on the system can provide spinning reserves. That's also a compensated service. Supplemental isn't more so fast start, but certainly not for renewable resources. And then our capacity accreditation systems today accredit dispatchable resources at basically 100% or very near, whereas renewable sources are accredited at much, much lower levels. So I guess my point is that there's a certain amount of that that's baked into the system as it exists today. I think as we look forward, the challenge that we and many others have is we don't know exactly what those other services are or how they should be defined or how they should be compensated. It becomes an academic exercise to try and figure out what those things are. And so FERC has opened the docket. It's underway. I think industry is waiting for some kind of guidance to come back from FERC that says, yes, these are the additional services that we need to consider, and these are some of the pricing mechanisms we might want to consider.
Well, I hope that the utilities, who know this business far better than a lot of the advocacy groups that are out there, who won't hesitate to get involved in these conversations with very strong opinions mm-hmm. and heavy-handed tools behind them, I hope that utilities like you and others get involved in those conversations and advocate for, you know, the whole fleet of options, not just what you think, you know, the other strong advocates are advocating for, et cetera. I mean, there's got to be some people with experience at the table talking about voltage support, frequency. These are important. These are vital to the grid, and we got to find a way to reward them so they exist long term. So, anyway, that's my pitch to you guys. Stay involved in the conversation with FERC.
No, I mean,
and myself and others.
Appreciate those comments, and I think there's that clearly is a becoming front and center. I think part of the challenge is, you know, separating it from the operating world as it exists today to this futuristic
right.
state. And I think that's where the focus, I mean, our position would be that today we're okay, mm-hmm. but we got to make sure that the mechanisms are in place that for the future, that if we do see the continued trend, you know, go like it is, we will have to do things differently.
Yeah.
And is there something that you can do or, you know, make sure that we don't miss an opportunity, I guess. So,
yeah, or be playing catch up because new rules have been created. You weren't involved in developing them as much as you maybe could have been, or you just went along with it, and now it's not as good as you'd like it to be, or it's going to be a lot more expensive for your customers or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'll jump on a couple of slides left, kind of related. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about electric vehicles and beneficial electrification. That whole beneficial electrification is something we're starting to hear of a lot more. And I don't know if they still teach it because I haven't had kids in school for a while, but back in the old days, we used to have those Venn diagrams, right? You'd have circles and, you know. So I think of beneficial electrification being the big circle. EVs are part of that, right? Just a small piece. And so I'll kind of try to talk about those together. If you look at CO2 generation today, a third of it generally is from electric, a third of it from transportation, a third of it from industry. It's kind of what we're thinking. And, you know, I think just up until a very recent past, our big adversaries were the environmental advocates. They would constantly be badgering electric utilities about you guys got to burn less coal because you're putting too much CO2 in the air. But I think when you look over the last 5 years with all the renewables that have been put on our system, really, electric utilities are the ones that are starting to have a decrease in their CO2. In fact, I just got this email that came today, and I was careful before I opened it. Cybersecurity, you know, we have all these tests every once in a while. You press the wrong button, and
you failed.
Right. So I try not to do that. But it said here in 2016, the transportation sector became the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. You know, so I think that, I don't know if they're growing anymore, but definitely us as electric utilities are starting to shrink with all the renewables that are going on. So what's happened is that, especially we see this in Minnesota because we have so many environmental advocacy groups that we deal with, all of a sudden they're starting to say, hey, electric utility, you guys aren't the bad guys. You're actually making headway in trying to reduce greenhouse gases. So thus, you're starting to see, you know, we used to, I think it was President Obama said, no more electric water heaters. Now it's like, hey, let's have electric water heaters because, you know, they're producing fewer greenhouse gases. So this electrification not only has got to do with vehicles, but it's got to do with space heating and water heating and processing. And I just saw on the news 2 nights ago on one of the Fargo stations that West Fargo just added a $300,000 electric bus for their school district. We're starting, I mean, so it's not just tiny little cars that would fit in the middle of the square, but it's starting to be school buses. We're starting to see, you know, there's some service vehicles that are starting to be electrified. And granted, there's some drawbacks. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, we had the McKnight Foundation, who funds a lot of the environmental groups, come to Fergus Falls, and they wanted to show up how electric cars are, right? So they drove an electric vehicle. Well, they got to Alexandria and they called and said, hey, we're going to be late because we got to stop it. We couldn't make it all the way to Fergus Falls.
Uh-huh.
And so that's okay, that's fine. So they're charging up. About a half hour later, we get another call. Well, it's going to be longer than we thought because it's taking us at least a couple hours to get charged up here. So they finally make it to Fergus Falls and they plug into our charging station. And the little display on their car comes up and says, you'll be fully charged at 2 a.m. today. So yeah, there's some drawbacks yet, but I think, you know, we're making big headway. We're starting to see longer ranges. So I think we'll start seeing that happen. The other thing I wanted to say is if you'll notice our presentation today was, you know, it's like 8 slides if you don't count the title and the thank you one at the back. So that's
half
a big deal because typically us as engineers.
Half were Stephanie's.
But, you know, typically, right, we used to put a bunch of words up. You guys could read them, but we'd read them back to you. So, again, that was Stephanie's push to say, okay, we're not doing that this time. We're just going to have a conversation and have much fewer slides. So I had one kind of on this that she made me take out because it was all kinds of graphs and lines and numbers. But I got to stand up one second, okay? So when you look at this, I think this is really what we're shooting for is if you look.
Just don't touch the screen because it's live and it might shoot you to the next, like,
screen. Oh.
You know, these are different cases, but if you just look at this gray one, this reference case, and you can see it on it's saying the total energy in our nation is going to go down 22% with beneficial electrification, but our electric loads go up 32%. And I think right there is the kind of the key of this whole slide. You don't need to look at all the rest of it, but we see our energy usage in our country going down as we become more efficient with things. Yet as we do this electrification, I think us as electric utilities and North Dakota as a coal-producing state and a petroleum-producing state, we're going to start to see natural gas and renewables and electricity use go up. So, you know, we always used to think it was this whole greenhouse gas thing was going to be the death knell of our industry. But I think we're starting to turn around and have some optimism. And I don't know if you've seen this. I brought some extras with, but this Charge Up North Dakota thing from the Lignite Energy Council. I mean, they're really, you can pass those around, but they're, you know, they're becoming really huge advocates for electric vehicles. And I don't know if you've seen the commercials on TV here, but there's one, a guy who works at a coal mine gets in his electric vehicle and drives it off the coal mine to go to work. I've just seen that in the Fargo stations. And I think, interesting, you know, the Lignite Energy Council and renewables have kind of been and sort of enemies in the past, and now it's all of a sudden like, hey, if we start, you know, having a combination of renewables and coal and everything, we can have more use for our product. And, you know, I think they're starting to jump on the bandwagon, and that's somebody we're starting to talk to, too, about this whole electric vehicle thing. So just a quote from Jason Bohr. I might even appear. No, I think I saw this on a newspaper article at the LEC. It says, the future is now for electric vehicles. And while we can all have different judgment about how soon that's going to come, you know, I think it was proved out with the McKnight Foundation that it isn't ready today. But I think, you know, 10 years from now, we're going to see probably a significant penetration of those electric vehicles. And so as electric utilities, that's going to be part something that we need to plan for when we do our resource plans. And I think with that, unless you want to talk any more about that, I'll just jump to our resource plan.
What I do have a question on that in terms of the infrastructure, the charging stations. Whose responsibility is that? Is it the utility? Is it a private entity over here that acts more as a?
We maybe have three different opinions right here on that. That's a hard question. In fact, you know, that's one of the things we're looking at right now is a possible test where we actually put some charging stations through our system, not just in Minnesota, but, you know, the freeways are probably going to get built out first with charging infrastructure because that's where most of the traffic is. But most of our customers don't live by freeways. So, you know, we're looking at a possible project to get some charging stations out in western Minnesota, eastern North Dakota. And then the question is who owns them? Do the utilities own them? We put them in rate base, or does some other third party own them and we sell the energy there? How do we bill for it? I mean, there's a lot of questions that we need to figure out. But we really believe that we're going to start needing to address some of those. And the only way we can address some of those is actually doing it. And so that's something that, you know, you may hear from us on in the next months or less than 2 years where we come and say, hey, here's this project. You know, is it something you think is worthwhile for us to invest in? And, you know, maybe it gets in rate base or whatever.
Would you develop a subsidiary?
You know, we haven't talked about that, but I mean, that certainly would be a possibility. I mean, I think the fundamental challenge that we see is it's, you know, you can't, it's hard to justify it. You can't justify it on the need, the demand of the system today, but it will never happen if you don't, you know, it's the build that they will come kind of is the way you need to think about this. And so I think at the end of the day, there's no simple answer to your question, Commissioner. And I think if you look around the country, you see various, there's no common model to how this plays out. But what we see is, you know, we're looking at it saying that, you know, it is in the future for us. I mean, they will be in our service. EVs will become more prevalent. We don't think we're certainly, our service territory is not going to be a early adopter, just for the very reasons of the example Brian gave, the range concerns and how are these things going to perform in the winter, to name a couple. But technology, you know, is going to improve, and we think that it will be here at some point. What's the role of the utility? We're trying to figure that out, and so. Well, more to come is really where we're.
You know, the
at.
Interesting thing too is Xcel. If you drive around the Twin Cities and you go to parking ramps, there's charging stations all over but it works well there because people drive 20, 30 miles. They can charge up, drive home. It's easy.
Is there a fee or how do they?
You know, yes, but I don't know. I've never looked because we don't have one.
Parking meter?
Yeah, you put your card in there.
Oh, right. Okay.
My understanding right now is the rate that a person pays is actually below cost.
Yes.
Oh. Yeah.
It usually is.
Because they're trying to get it off the ground and hit critical mass and then take it from there. And I ask the question, it's more of a hypothetical question, because I go through the same, well, from an economic standpoint, I could see it this model. Economic standpoint, I could see this model. And I don't know.
If you come up with the answer, let us know.
Well, the hard part is rate of adoption, technology, advancing technology in terms of, I think, one of the critical elements, charging time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise range will continue to be a significant challenge. You know, it's different, I think, having at-home charging, a means to charge, you know, right? You know, you roll it into your garage. I was talking to someone, they roll in and they don't even plug in. It just charges. However that works.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they were just telling me a tall tale, but go over some pad, and I don't know what's going on. But with that, but no, if you're going to and from work, and it's, you know, 5 mile commute one way and 5 miles back, and you can top it off in the evening or, you know, in the overnight hours, then. But are you going to take it from Bismarck to the Twin Cities for Thanksgiving? Mm-hmm. Well, not today.
Not today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. No, Bruce always worried, if he was here, he'd probably tell a story. He's always worried about, we'll put in this charging structure and who'll use it, because we don't have that many electric vehicles in our area. All the people from Xcel who come up to go to the lakes in the summer, right? It'll be Xcel customers. And I call him President Trump, right? It's like, he's going to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it. And I said, we're going to put the charging stations. He's going to make Xcel pay us for putting them in. So I don't know.
Of course, in Minnesota, it's probably going to go electric vehicles, electric boats.
Right.
Well, okay, so we have a little more dangerous.
15 minutes left, so just talk a little about our resource plan. So our resource plan in Minnesota, we're not required to file in North Dakota or South Dakota, but every time we file one in Minnesota, we actually do file it with the North Dakota Commission and make sure we come out and visit with you about what's included there. So currently our resource plan was scheduled to be filed June 3rd of 2019, so next summer. But because we don't have in our resource plan, we really critically look at the first 5 years. And we've got Maricourt going and Astoria going. We don't really have any other big new construction projects in the first 5 years. And then we are waiting on to get some more clarity on the regional haze, the EPA's regional haze rule in North Dakota, and that new ACE rule. And also the software that we use to do our planning. I'm sure you've heard us mention the word strategist before, or you've heard Xcel talk about it. We've all got together in Minnesota, Xcel, Minnesota Power, Great River Energy, and Otter Tail to choose a new software package because Strategist is no longer supported. So we've moved to one called Encompass. And Excel won't have that in place for their next resource plan, but we plan on using it for our next one. So for all those reasons, we've decided, we've asked for a one-year extension in Minnesota to June 1 of 2020. Our hearing before the commission is next Thursday, the 29th. And we've got really strong indication from commission staff as well as all the parties that everybody will agree to that. So just to put you on notice or let you know that our next resource plan that you'll see from us got pushed out 1 year to June 1st of 2020. One of the critical things I think I'd like to talk about that, though, we really expect that our next resource plan is going to look pretty different from the ones in the past. If you look at our earlier ones, like our most recent one we had the Astoria gas plant and some wind. But, you know, the way things are looking right now with economics and we keep seeing capital costs for both wind, solar, and now even storage in certain situations, prices that are becoming very low. We're seeing very much increased capacity factors. So what we're seeing in our preliminary modeling, we're always doing modeling on our resource planning just to kind of see where things are going. I'd be really, you know, I think just to let you know that I would really expect our next resource plan to be heavy on renewables. It will have, for replacements we have, it's probably going to be some solar. We've had offers consistently now in the low $40 a megawatt hour, and we've actually had a couple that have dropped under $40 a megawatt hour. We're seeing capacity factors of 23, 24, 25% on some of the projects that have been proposed to us. So it's getting to be very inexpensive. And one of the things we're always concerned about in the Dakotas is having a least cost resource plan. And so, as I told you, we're consistently doing modeling to see where we're at. And our calculations for us, I'm sure it's different for every utility, but for Otter Tail Power, we sort of feel that $35 about is the break-even point. If we can get solar beneath $35, we think we can come to you and show you a strong case that's part of a cost-effective resource mix. It's not quite there, but it's getting really, really close. And I think this extra one-year delay that we're going to have in our resource plan will cause that as we look out into the future, 2 and 3 and 5 years down the road, it'll be a part of our least cost resource plan. So it's more or less just to let you know that we're really seeing that, and I'm quite confident that our resource plan will have solar as a major part of our next resource additions. One note on that, too, is that you're aware, I'm sure, that we have a 1.5% solar requirement in Minnesota starting in 2020. But again, because we weren't able to get solar resources that met that criteria being least cost in North Dakota, we have purchased enough solar renewable energy credits for all of 2020 and a really big part of 2021 at a really, really low cost. The beauty of that is we'll meet Minnesota's requirement, and we can directly assign the costs of purchasing those RECs totally to Minnesota. So we'll meet the requirement in Minnesota, but North Dakota and South Dakota customers won't be charged a penny for us meeting those requirements.
Do you believe you'll be able to meet that requirement through RECs for the foreseeable future and beyond 2020, 2021?
Yes, but I really believe, too, that we'll start. So in Minnesota, we need about 25 megawatts of solar to meet our requirement. I really believe that we'll start seeing, you know, when we do a resource plan, we may come in and say, hey, we want to build 50 megawatts because it's least cost. And if it is part of a least cost plan, then, of course, we won't be out trying to procure RECs anymore.
So are those, of course, I would imagine the availability and pricing of the RECs could also change over the course of time depending on what other states mandate.
Right.
Correct.
Yep.
So not owning puts you at a disadvantage.
Good.
It creates the exposure of what those markets do by not owning it. But I think fundamentally, to answer your question, we would intend to continue purchasing those RECs for Minnesota compliance until we can demonstrate a least cost project for all states.
Okay, and you're not being pushed by a tightening market at this point?
No, just
no,
the opposite
going
right
the other
now.
Way, they're getting cheaper all the time we wait.
Right.
Another interesting point is of that 1.5%, we have to get 10% of that from small solar, which is under 40 kW. It was 20, but now it's 40.
Why is that?
It was a blatant economic development on part of the solar industry to force utilities to pay exorbitant rates for rooftop solar. which doesn't make any financial sense, if I can say what's on my mind.
No, you can.
Yeah, okay, so but anyway, so that's the hard part. We don't get any requests for small solar. You know, it's funny. Well, I mean, I don't know, in a handful, in a year, people call in and say, you know, I'm interested in putting rooftop solar, and we kind of talk about the prices, and then we don't hear again because it's too expensive. So that's a real problem for us because we still, by law, have to get that 10% of our 1.5% from these small customers. Well, we couldn't find any of those small solar RECs. Just yesterday, a bunch became available at a really low price. Mm-hmm. So, again, we'll be able to meet Minnesota's requirement and charge it all to Minnesota. So I think that's, you know, that's the hard part there. I mean, because that's pretty much for sure causes us to do something that's not economic if we have to get, you know, those small solar.
But, and that's, well, I'm just curious what the thinking on the Minnesota side of the equation, the commission, in terms of knowing it's going to cost ratepayers more. But it's
you know, there's a bunch of things that go into that, one being externalities. We have to use these really high externality values, so that tends to make it look a little better. You know, there's higher rates by some of the utilities in Minnesota, which tend to make them pay off a little bit quicker. But, and you know, don't we think one of the things we're expecting to see maybe in Minnesota is a 50% renewable standard. It's going to come up in front of the legislature. We don't know if that's going to pass or not.
They have so many interveners, too, environmental groups that Absolutely. Are so active, and so they've just got this groundswell of support for things that low rates. Who's advocating for the low rates? Industrial customers? Chamber? I don't know. In Minnesota, who does it?
Yeah, they do.
They do.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, definitely a different environment, and you know, there are there's not as many, you know, advocates for just kind of pure lease cost perspective, more advocates for kind of societal valuation, if you, for lack of a better term to use. And, you know, I think in some of the information that you can look at from various groups, I mean, they will show, you know, how Minnesota rates have, you know, kind of been on a pretty big incline. And so, but I don't think it's a, situation where it's, you know, that they're not, they're recognizing that it isn't lease cost. I mean, I guess is my, it's just a different environment.
And you know, one of the things I think I'd like to take credit for, you know, if you remember, I have that one slide where the person's walking the tightrope between the Dakotas and Minnesota, trying not to fall off, and I think so. Stephanie wouldn't let me put that in either. So now that she's not here, I know. But, you know, really, I think we've done a job where we haven't added any resources that this commission has looked at and said it's not cost effective. And that'll always be our goal, to keep doing that. And at the same time, meeting our requirements in the state of Minnesota. But I think one of the things that I think we should take credit for as a company is we've been persistent and consistent in Minnesota with commission and staff and Department of Commerce, continually pounding home that message that we're a small utility. We got half our loads in Minnesota and the other half is in North Dakota and South Dakota. And you need to be aware of that before you make any decisions that, you know, really treat us, you know, put us in a bad spot where we'd half of our investment that we couldn't get recovery on. And I think that consistent, persistent message has caused them at least always to consider that in their decisions. Not that we always get the decision we like, but I really believe they keep that in mind as they do things about, like, say, with our resource plan. But
it seems like you guys have done a good job of that. So I hear that from the commissioners over there, that they recognize the difference between your customer base and Xcel's, and they're totally willing to treat you guys differently as a result
right.
of it. So,
yeah, and I think we've put a big emphasis on trying to create that education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, you know, when you think about it and you look at our service territory in Minnesota, you look at it in North Dakota, you look at it in South Dakota, while there's the political boundaries, I mean, the communities that we serve in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota look identical.
Yeah.
I mean, their customers are the same. I mean, they look very much the same. It's just happens that the Red River, excuse me, divides us.
Right. You know what else I find really interesting is I call Minneapolis-St. Paul, you know, the 494, 694 beltway that goes around them. And you step inside the beltway, and it's just a whole different philosophy. Yet everybody who comes to the table in our resource plans and rate proceedings, they all live inside the beltway, you know, and don't represent our customers. I don't know how much you see it out here, but I think when you start seeing Fargo's starting to get that way, you know, and I think there's something you might start to see as a commission 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road, start to see that more environmental activism kind of thing. Because I just see it on things that appear in the Fargo Forum or just watching the local news. That whole thing is starting, you got all the colleges there, and I think you'll start to divide your state into two pieces a little bit, which makes your job much more interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it does.
So I don't really have anything more to talk about in our resource plan, just that, you know, we'll do our best to keep you up to date. And, you know, if you want to just, anything you want to close with, I just.
Yeah, I mean, I just, again, want to say thanks for taking the time to, and excuse me for my loss of my voice now. Maybe I should have stayed back.
Yeah.
No, I'm feeling well. But, you know, I think what we would like to do is it had actually been quite a while since we'd had a PIE meeting. And so I think we would like to see probably that we'll likely like to do this a little more often. I think, you know, based on our conversation today, I think clearly resilience is a potential topic that we could have in the future. Cybersecurity would be another example. I think there's a lot of things, you know, I think this pace of change in our industry is, you know, it's really picked up. And so I think a big, you know, important part for us from our perspective is that we're communicating well on what we see and kind of the signaling the direction that we want to go and the direction that we are going. And so I think this is a great venue to be able to have a dialogue. I mean, truly, I mean, it was great that, you know, we can kind of do it a Q&A almost. So we very much appreciate that. And so we've got a lot on our plate. You know, I think our team is I'm very proud of our team at OTP and what we're doing, and we got another 5-year plan in front of us where we've got a lot of exciting things going on and that we need to execute very, very well on and develop these plans for the future. Our Innovation 2030, I think, is a key element of kind of the next kind of what I'd characterize as the next big thing for OTP. I mean, it has, in the more recent terms, it's been the replacement of Hoot Lake Plant with the Astoria and Maricourt project, getting those approval, the development approvals that we need. Now, hopefully, within the next year, we're fully into construction on both of those. And our resource plan, obviously, is going to be a big thing for us, you know, going forward in as well. So thank you for the opportunity today to be with you.
Thank you.
Pat?
My copy of the slides has something written on the front?
I wrote it on there before.
Did you?
We all got that.
Were we going to ask that?
Huh? Oh, I was not. Okay. I was just a note for myself. I was on there. We copies.
Compliance filing. Yes. All right. Yes, we'll get that message back. We'll get it.
Any other questions before we wrap this up? I will say I hope it wasn't a big inconvenience, but thank you for moving up the starting time a little bit earlier. It was only a half hour, but it made the difference in us being able to schedule another pretty important meeting in this afternoon. So appreciate that. Thank you.
We'll eat lots of turkey.